previously.tv podcast network.
Rajneeshpuram is a big living opera. Sheila soprano, Bhagwan a tenor, Rajneeshpuram the setting. Operas are at the end always tragic, but there were so many facets, so many dimensions in this opera. I would like to say, people of Oregon, think yourself lucky that this opera came your way.
In the Pacific Northwest, quote, family values collided with free love, salmonella, and a bad lieutenant. In South Beach, the Fontainebleau Hotel heirs collided with a greedy, scorned wife, her brother, and a script studded with overdetermined comic book imagery. Kevin Smokler and I collude on a discussion of Netflix's Wild Wild Country and Lifetime's Beautiful and Twisted on The Blotter Presents, episode 53. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, previously.tv's take on all things TV true crime. I am joined once again by one of the, I'm going to say, seven other non-Mennonite people who has not seen Wild Wild Country yet, returning guest Kevin Smokler. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for doing this. I feel and think a lot of things about this documentary series from the Duplass brothers. Before we get into it, first, an all-points bulletin. There is no new Blotter Presents next week due to the mainland transfer of the Cole Ariano household from Hawaii to Texas. Stick around to the end of this episode for what will be coming up, including actually another documentary series on Netflix from this same production team. So that should be fun. It involves a bank robbery. It's a little less creepy. I hope.
Red Roby.
I don't know. But yes, that is all coming up. That will be in our Be on the Lookout section at the end of the podcast. For now, let's get into our Most Wanted section. Wild Wild Country, the documentary series directed by McLean and Chapman Way, who we'll get into their resume a bit later. The series everyone was talking about like 2 weeks ago, but better late than never. We're getting into it. Here's the case file per the IMDb. When the world's most controversial guru builds a utopian city deep in the Oregon desert, conflict with the locals escalates into a national scandal. End quote. Often called a sex cult, the Rajneeshi and their bright-colored togs believed in a more nuanced focus on joy and laughter, but were not above bigfooting an entire small town to occupy its power structure, poison hundreds with engineered salmonella, and go on offense in the press while quietly trying to taint the Wasco County water supply with blended beaver parts. Also, they were fucking in front of federal investigators.
Everyone's funny because it's true.
I mean, maybe it's true. We'll get into that later. Yeah. Everyone's been talking about Wild Wild Country for weeks now. It's from directors and brothers McLean and Chapman Way, who did The Battered Bastards of Baseball about their grandfather, Bing Russell. It's very good. I recommend it if you're into like the vagaries of minor league team ownership and also how cute Kurt Russell still is. How's that possible? Despite the scads of press that this series has received, I still have a lot of questions. And Kevin, I feel like you, having sent me a bullet pointed
list of said questions.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extremely watchable series, and you almost don't notice, or I didn't notice until several episodes in, how much wasn't even in there. And that was something that was a theme that came up in your discussion points. What did you think?
Yeah. There are, you're right. It is tremendous fun in so far as a terribly misled group of naive young people is, you know, reliving the tragic outcomes of being so misled could be fun. But it's a lot of fun to watch. The six parts goes by in a flash. But if you cut just below the surface, you're left with a lot of sort of troubling open questions and assertions not followed up on, which I find then adds up to a 6 hour laying out of evidence without any real point of view or a conclusion. And I feel like the Way brothers would say, well, that was the idea. And to me, that feels like submitting the penultimate draft as the final draft. Submitting the reporting and the evidence as the end of the story when the final draft, at least in my understanding, should be shaping it into something. Even if what you're saying is there's a lot of possibilities here. We don't have one. To me, it didn't even take that last step.
Or there needed to be, I don't know, like they had extraordinary access to all of the figures involved, except, mm-hmm. of course, Osho, who passed away when you and I were young, which means it was a long time ago, teehee. but they, like his notorious lieutenant, who we heard at the top of the episode, Ma'anan Sheela, the groups, I'm not entirely comfortable calling it a cult, frankly. Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about that later, but the group's attorney who sort of had gone to India to visit Osho in his original ashram, sort of seeking something besides his high powered fast lane life as a Los Angeles entertainment litigator. Mm-hmm. And often, and I think this is something you pointed out in your pre-notes, that often when there's a series like this, like the HBO Scientology project, or I'm trying to think of another example.
Maybe like the Heaven's Gate podcast series that came out recently, or the other thing I was thinking of is the CNN documentary Holy Hell that I think came out last year, which wasn't a serial. It was all one part, but very, very similar subject matter, similarly contradictory pieces of evidence presented. And in that one, the leader of the organization was still alive, and the filmmakers did have access to him.
But I think there's often this build to, and certainly in the American experience about Jonestown and the People's Temple, that much of the beginning is devoted to like contemporaneous footage paired with present day talking head interviews with either whatever survivors or previous members of the group explaining how they got caught up with these crazers. And you do have that in this one. Here's clip two. I believe this man's name is, or he's known as Niren. Now he looks like Alan to me, but Niren is his name. And here he is talking about arriving at the ashram and feeling like he had come home.
There's lots of trees, these beautiful old trees full of parrots, like thousands of parrots. And all of these people, a sea of people walking, wearing maroon robes. But it was a very gentle movement, you know, people talking to people, people sitting and having a cup of tea, people hugging. I just wanted to be there. I felt like I had arrived. I felt like after a life of being somewhere where I felt I don't belong here, including my family, I felt like I had come home.
He gave hours and hours of testimony in this series, and he's extremely articulate and also very readily emotional still about everything that happened and about this community, but this is a fairly standard reporting, I think, whether they use these words or not, from members past or present of a cult or a religion or whatever, this feeling of homecoming and being understood by others and feeling familial and collegial, like seemingly for the first time. So nothing unusual there.
No. And I think what the point Wild Country does raise, which the Holy Hell documentary and the Heaven's Gate podcast and perhaps the Jonestown story raises is this question of scale. I mean, there were 20, 30 people in Heaven's Gate. There were maybe 50 in the Holy Hell group in Southern California in the early 1980s. There was probably, I think, 1,000 total in Jonestown. But we're talking about tens of thousands in this case. And I think what that underlines I think you can make an argument for anything, any story about a group that takes people in who are looking for something and they find out that the homecoming they felt when they arrived was built on kind of lies and deceit and exploitation of their faith and their need for such a thing. I find it easier to dismiss when it's 20 or 30 people, because in any large segment of people, there's always going to be a few who don't fit in. But when you're talking about something that speaks to tens of thousands of people who feel unwelcome in the lives they were born into, I'm not suggesting I'm going to run out and buy a red robe, but or wear one. But it does seem contained in that piece of evidence and the scale at which the Rajneeshi worked is this underlying dread and sadness of what is the world we've created where this many people feel like they don't belong in it.
Well, I think there's also, there was enough like contemporary footage of some of these like encounter therapy groups that I think that the locals and, conservative Christian people in 1981 mm-hmm. were not trying to hear about people. First of all, there is something that immediately gets the hackles up of, newcomers who don't appear to be beaten down by life or like are having fun. Like there is definitely something among social conservatives, I have always felt in this country that a big part of it is like, y'all are having more fun than us and that won't stand. But the consistently headlines and reviews or think pieces about this documentary is referring to the Rajneeshi as a sex cult. And there's a hilarious clip from a federal investigator that we'll hear later in the podcast about this. He's like, yeah, I was driving into town and they were just, doing it on a bridge. Like, all right, well, that's maybe a lot. But I didn't get the sense that that was like foundational to the group, but I also got no sense of it from the documentary. Like what was the deal? I mean, I think part of the problem is that the whole queer spectrum was NBD, which mm-hmm. is great, but the locals clearly were not going to have that. Yeah. But then there's also like this throwaway comment at one point about how, they did it a lot and they, did it with whoever, but there weren't a lot of pregnancies. Like, okay, that's interesting. Cause yeah, I mean, even the Manson girls got knocked up. Like, so what was the position on birth control? Like, maybe they had their own Planned Parenthood in the compound. They had everything else in there.
Yeah. You ask a really good question. I mean, the documentary is curiously sort of underinformed on like what did the day-to-day life of a Rajneeshi believer and follower look like? I mean, this place was unabashedly capitalist. They were essentially running their own small city industries, medical institutions, transportation systems, and all. And
but how?
Exactly. Like, is everybody assigned a job when they show up? How do people get paid? You know, how do people, and it kind of overlaps with this, one of the things that the federal government, you know, ultimately brought against the Rajneesh is, apparently the largest immigration fraud in U.S. history. The Rajneesh sent people to different states, one a citizen, one not, under the guise of getting married, essentially so they could procure the non-citizen a green card, thereby defrauding the immigration system. And I'm like, that's great, but what the movie doesn't tell you is for what exactly?
Yeah.
So what if the people are now legally married or one has a green card? Was this to build up followers? Was this to increase the voting base in Oregon when Rajneesh started running for local and county elections? You don't really know what a daily life of one of these people are like, and where the sort of life cycle events of living in a self-contained universe for 4 years come.
There's no allegation that any minors were that sexual assault or harassment was a problem. It doesn't mean it wasn't. But that is not looked at all either way. There's no allegation that minors were corrupted or harmed. We know there were a handful present. That one Australian devotee who tried to like murder Osho's doctor, but even that, like. I'm going back now to what you said earlier in the podcast about this feeling like not quite the final draft. Like, I think there is a danger in being, you know, the sort of documentarian that feels like they can't take a position. Because then you'll get accusations from whatever the right about how you're Michael Moore. And it's like, it's really not possible without just running unedited footage a la Warhol to not take a position, like just by choosing this topic.
Yeah. I mean, if what you're saying is this is an important story in the history of Oregon, in the history of Reagan America, in the history of, you know, religious sex with tragic consequences in this country. Okay, fine. You can accomplish that in an hour, or you could accomplish that by simply running some headlines of, you know, that I'm not even going to say that's essentially a 60 Minutes episode where you run some footage of Jonestown and some footage of a few other cults of that nature, and then plug a 15 minute news piece of the Rajneesh in the middle of it and call it a day.
Right. Because
story of this length.
Yeah.
Seems to me that you have something to say besides look at all the exhaustive and thorough reporting we did on it.
I mean, because no position is really taken on, like clearly there was a ton of money, but it's unclear who benefited from it, where it came from, where it went. And even law enforcement at the federal level didn't appear to think that it was about like ill-gotten gains, which I think a lot of these, you know, religion, you know, .inc outfits are about. But I mean, here's one of the, you know, attorneys talking about what it's not about.
Well, let me just finish my statement. This was not motivated by greed. This was evil.
Okay, but multiple Rolls Royces, and I don't mean three. I mean, like, 19.
Like a row where an entire, you know, an entire football team offensive and defense could have one. Including the place
so
kicker,
like,
you know.
Where, I don't know, like, I would say they buried the lead, but it's like there's a bunch of different leads, and they kind of buried all of them. Like, if there's anything that I sort of, like, I wanted to know more and yet less. Like, who is this? What is this for? What are you trying to say? Because, again, it's an extremely watchable work. And I'm not saying that it's bad or a waste of time or pointless or anything, because it's none of those things. But I think it's almost actually about like electoral change on the municipal level more than it's about any of these other issues. Because so much time is devoted to how they're packing the city council. Like,
oh, yeah.
Okay, cool. Like, look, we want to turn the, you know, blue tide. Yay. But, okay. Like,
what? Yeah, I mean, welcome to, you know, they devote like an episode and a half to it. Like you're saying, like a ridiculous amount given, you know, given the 6 hour running time of this thing. And I think the movie unfairly stacks the deck that the Rajneeshi are up to something sinister and undemocratic by doing this. And point blank, you know, to look at it very simplistically, you can say, well, sure they were. They were, you know, flooding the small county with homeless people from out of state in exploitation of Oregon's voter laws just so they could get their own people on the city council. Fine. Welcome to politics American style. I mean, that's, you know, that's Tammany Hall. That's Boss Tweed. That's every election
that's
Chicago
New Jersey,
had before.
Like, yeah. You're going to have to get up a little earlier to freak me out with that shit. Sorry.
No kidding. I mean, and I think the movie really tries to have it both ways by saying that there's something, there was something culturally prejudiced or downright racist about implying that the Rajneeshi were up to something sinister that wasn't as American as a roadside diner in a Chevrolet. But also, I think the movie is critical of that notion, but it's also saying, well, look, the people who believe those bigoted things about the Rajneeshi were right. They were up to something sinister. So perhaps when a brown person in long robes moves to your town, you should rightly think they are up to felonious behavior.
Yeah. And there is like Jonestown had really just happened. And I think that was like a sufficiently like that was nearly 1,000 people who perished. That was, yeah. And, but I mean, talk about American as apple pie and Chevrolets, like the religious huckster, absolutely an American institution, oh, alas.
Yeah.
Starting the religious huckster. Cotton Mather, I'm sure. But like from law enforcement's perspective, at least on like the federal or regional level, I can absolutely see that they're like, well, the thing is that Jonestown looked like a, you know, harmless, happy, whatever from the outside. And then, you know, gallons of Flavor Aid later, here we all are with Leo Ryan dead on some tarmac. Like, this is not, and they had guns. So that is legitimate. And they talk a little bit about that in clip four.
In, you know, Jonestown had happened not that long ago. And we openly worried about whether a Jonestown type event was possible, because when people completely surrender their free will to some leader like the Bhagwan, it opens the prospect that they can do things that seem completely inexplicable. We were worried about that.
Sure. Yeah. Fine.
Go ahead.
Because I wanted to carry forward your thoughts about, like, you know, what exactly got the hackles up about this community, but that goes into our next clip. So please go ahead.
Yeah. The missing opportunity for the documentary here is not that, that Jonestown had just happened. That is true, but that's only half the story, because when the Jonestown church set up shop in San Francisco before it was Jonestown in Guyana, Jim Jones was a local politician in addition to being a religious leader of this church. You know, he served on the housing committee, and there's pictures of him with then city councilman, soon to be mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown. He was a part of the local political establishment. And the idea of a religious figure new in town from out of state suddenly commanding, you know, seemingly blindly devoted followers and local political office Yeah, that is a scary American tradition going back at least to Father Conklin and to other creepy people with nefarious aims like that.
Yes, charismatic cretins. And it's worth noting that Jim Jones also, and I think this was sincere at first, sort of spiritually enfranchised people of color. Mm-hmm. In a way that similar figures were not doing. He later leveraged that to disastrous and racist effect, but that was, you know, that was a similar issue. And eventually I think San Francisco power structure was kind of like, why don't you think about Barstow? We hear it's nice up there. Yeah. Like they were just kind of, ooh, creeped out by him.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, he was obviously up to no good. And I think he was running afoul of the law in San Francisco, which is what caused the pulling up stakes of the People's Church, you know,
yep, right pretty there sure.
on Geary Street. But the idea that the reminder of Jonestown is incomplete and colored in this movie, because as we were discussing before, you know, in the days and hours leading up to the show, Wild Wild Country does not submit that anybody is kept there against their will, or that anybody is asked to, you know, surrender their possessions or engage in sort of self-nullifying behavior in order to belong to this group.
Correct.
Which to me, I don't know, strikes me as perhaps a failure of reporting. They couldn't find someone who went to Rajneeshpuram, said, hey, that's not for me, and then left. Or, hey, it kind of creeped me out and didn't stick around. They could only find the most devoted and the most faithful.
Yeah, that is odd. Or stories of, well, we'll get into the ballot box stuffing experiment. But there's also the fact that the public face of this movement was a woman of color who did not seem to understand and still does not seem to understand what the words low and profile might look like for her when they're next to each other. Clip 5.
How could you do that? How could you? I said, don't tell me. I'm doing my job. That's it.
Sheila, whatever your plans are, we don't want the Rajneeshis. We don't want the orange people in our town.
What can I say? Tough titties.
I think I'm just going to make that a permanent clip for the Blotter soundboard. What can I say?
That's a ringtone waiting to happen.
Just the pronunciation of titties. It's completely juvenile. And yet these, you know, members of this group went out to all these cities with, you know, a bus and bus tickets and found people living outdoors down on their luck. Suggested that they come hang out, they'd be fed, they get 2 beers a day. The work detail was, I mean, what they were doing in this case was illegal. Mm-hmm. And not above board. And when some of these troubled gentlemen began acting out, the solution was absolutely not okay. If you follow us on either of our social media outposts, Facebook or Twitter at Blotter Presents, you will see a darkly hilarious picture from the documentary of a portrait of Osho over this neat, like it almost looks like a medical rep setup of Haldol. And let's hear about that in clip 6.
One of the doctors had come. They sedated him, put him in a car, drove him off Rajneeshpuram, off the ranch, and set him out on a park bench. In an effort to reduce the chaos, it was decided that the way to deal with this situation was to sedate all of the homeless people. So Haldol, a sedative, was put into the beer that was served to the homeless people with their evening meal. Nobody asked them if that was okay. They did not know that they were being drugged.
Okay. That is profoundly fucked up. But then, all right, here, I have two. This is a package containing two problems, as my dad's business partner would say. One is that my feeling was that the subject was kind of changed to, or that whole segment was really a bit like not on the Rajneeshi's side exactly, but that there was this kind of like editorial shrug that's like, well, what would you do? Like, well, not that. Fuck. You don't drug people. But here's the other thing. I think that the movie does not take, because some of their actions are so outlandish, like this sounds almost like not comical, but like farcical, I guess. Like the beaver thing and the salmonella. Like salmonella is not a fucking joke. Nobody can have a Caesar salad in this country right now because of salmonella. But like, because it's like, you know, Barney sneezing on the salad bar in The Simpsons kind of a thing, that I don't think the documentary necessarily underlines that hundreds of people, including like pregnant women and the elderly, were sickened to the point of having to go to the hospital. Like, that's a terrorist act, period. Yeah.
It doesn't like it neglects to simply reporting on those things opens up much bigger questions to me, which maybe the film doesn't feel like it has time to answer, or maybe it feels like it's a rabbit hole. But like, okay, like if you're sedating the homeless population of this of Rajneeshpuram by spiking the beer, like, are the homeless folks the only ones who drink beer? How do we know who the homeless folks are at Rajneeshpuram unless we have some sort of segregated Jim Crow two-tier society at this city, which is something that is not explored or not opened up. Well,
and also, it was decided.
Don't do
that. Like, I'm sorry if anyone felt offended. No. Who decided?
Yeah, and the movie never settles the question of what all the money is going towards. This organization, this small city, apparently has ungodly amounts of money. And perhaps they were not prepared for the quite probable mental and physical issues that are going to come with trucking in a homeless population from 15 outlying states. Well, you know what? Throw a bunch of money at a health clinic and get these people what they need. Wasn't that the care that the homeless people that whose interview footage they had, wasn't that the care they were talking about? Wasn't that why the homeless population or certain parts of it felt happy at this place in the first place?
Yeah.
I understand that when you are talking that this is a complex story worthy of this much time and investigation. I don't feel like I need to be led by the hand by the filmmakers, but I also feel like to assert something that opens up three or four other questions and to just kind of sally forth from there, it feels a little breezy and irresponsible to me.
Isn't this story crazy? Ha ha. Like, how is it that you could not find one of these people who would speak to you?
Yeah.
I guess it's not impossible that many of them could have died or you couldn't track them down. Like, that's absolutely possible. But there are many instances in which I absolutely agree with you. Like, even if it's not irresponsible, it's a little bit not immature either. I don't know what the word is that I'm looking for.
It feels
just a, like, it's not lack of compassion exactly. I don't know. I just think that they're like, it's kind of an anything for the punchline situation that didn't always sit terribly well with me. And then it devolves into a he said, she said between Osho and Sheila, who allegedly leaves with like all these suitcases full of money. Do we hear about that anymore? No.
Yeah.
And then law enforcement, as if there weren't I don't know. I feel like the whole, one of the central ideas of this documentary is like somewhere in the middle between these two sides, whether it's Osho versus Sheila, the town of Antelope versus the Rajneeshi, family values versus free love, the, you know, end of the 60s and the beginning of the 80s, whatever it is, that the truth is somewhere in the middle. And then you have this guy telling this completely insane story. This is like a United States attorney. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, well, maybe I heard that. And then you have a little editing thing at the end. Like, it's extremely well edited, but it's, I felt a little cheap laughing. Let's hear clip seven so that I don't over-explain it too vaguely.
When Bhagwan made these allegations, that gave us the key to the door.
Oh, excuse me. This is the guy talking about seeing people fornicating. So let's listen to him, and then we'll hear clip eight, which is what I was actually talking about.
When Bhagwan made these allegations, that gave us the key to the door. As I drove into town, the first thing I saw was a couple engaged in sex on a bridge at the far west end of the community. And that more or less set the stage for a very bizarre 2 months that I spent in this commune conducting a federal investigation. sex between commune members was open and frequent, and all types of things were condoned that you wouldn't find out in other parts of the state of Oregon.
Okay, so fine. Not everyone likes to wear clothes. Not everyone likes the opposite sex. Get over it.
Is this Bill Braverman's son who's doing this talking, the guy with the cowboy hat?
Maybe.
Yeah.
That's not him.
Okay. All right.
No, it's like that's contemporary footage of a guy like speaking for a news report in like 1985.
Gotcha.
Here is the U.S. attorney who is talking about the poisoning the well, their attempts to poison the well with blended beaver shakes, allegedly, and in relating this story, he poisons his own well by being like at the end, well, I don't know, someone told me that. And then the directors poison their well by immediately cutting in a townsperson at the end. Here's clip eight.
Someone had read somewhere that beavers were a particularly bad source of bacteria. So they decided that they would introduce beavers to the water system for the dows. They went out with beavers, only to discover that there was just a small gap between the solid lid and the wall that was covered with wire mesh. So they couldn't get the beavers into the water supply.
I had a nickel.
So they went back and they killed the beavers and they put them in blenders and they blended the beavers and then poured the blended beavers into the water supply.
It seems so much more complicated.
A true story, but it's a story that was told to me by someone who was there.
These people are crazy.
I mean, look.
Yeah.
I'm a writer. You're a writer, Kevin.
Yeah.
That a story that good, like blended the beavers, like that is the kind of shit that as a like producer of narrative, you wait for years sometimes.
Yes.
But it does feel irresponsible that they left it in. And also, I have so many follow-up questions just about beaver acquisition.
Me too.
Beaver
and
transport.
Right. Beaver. Right. Beaver carrying to get them to the water supply thing. The apparent lack of wire cutters in a small city that has 20 Rolls Royces. You couldn't cut through the wire mesh. You had to turn the beavers into liquid to get them in there.
I know, like you went to all that trouble and it's like you had one job. I'm just imagining this one guy whose, you know, name used to be Kevin and is
right.
Now, who knows?
Right. Yeah. Kaporum or something like that.
Like,
you know.
Oh, Ma Anand Kevin, you had one job.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just feel like there's not I don't have any recollection of this story from when it was happening, at which time I was in like late grade school, early middle school. I was like,
yeah, you and I are the same age. So.
Yeah. So 81, I was eight. I don't remember it locally. I don't remember it nationally. I had never heard of it in the intervening time. I think it was just one of those things that, like, once it was all over, the water kind of closed over the story. It was on the other side of the country. It was a rural, I don't know, but like, there's footage of all three big three news anchors talking about it repeatedly. Mm-hmm. Sheila was on Donahue. She was on Oprah. Like, everybody was talking about this, and then the story just disappeared. Like, I think it's a good topic, but that problem that you pointed out remains, that it's like, I'm not sure that resurfacing the facts in evidence excuse the filmmakers from like pressing the interviewees more on whether they feel any remorse. Certainly, I think they tried with Sheila, and she just gave one of those like garbage time non-answers that she quickly becomes known for.
Right. And then the film includes some tiny little button at the end of Sheila saying, have we talked enough? Like, let's get a drink or something like that, which to me always sounds overly congenial between filmmakers and subject.
And also means they didn't know how to end it.
Oh, so true. Like, I mean, like, I was thinking The Defiant Ones ends that way, the documentary about Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine. Uh-huh. But everybody you're talking to, all of the talking heads in that movie have worked with these two men, have mostly fond things to say about them. And that is a movie about work and the product of work. And so it kind of makes sense for them at the end to say, well, that was great, you know. As if, you know, as like packing up the studio at the end of a recording day. That didn't make
yeah,
didn't
you're
make
not
any
talking
sense
about somebody who was like convicted of attempted murder, basically, and then deported.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, well, that was fun to revisit this time in my life. Cocktail? Like, nope.
Yeah. And I'm sure you've noticed that all of the packaging and promotional material for this movie is the visage of the Bhagwan and not of Sheila. And of course, the man is dead. We don't have him around to ask questions of.
Yeah.
But the movie makes a concerted visual attempt to paint him as an evil person who took a bunch of naive people for a ride and committed acts of government fraud and maybe at the best was naive about what his generals and lieutenants were planning.
Yeah, I just couldn't get any sense one way or the other of whether he was involved or had any, you know, had plausible deniability. Like, I can see him asking Sheila to get certain things done and then not being all that interested in how it was accomplished. But, like, we don't know what his day-to-day was either. He's, like, barely in the story for episodes at a time.
Yes, for having the biggest face on the poster, he's in the story surprisingly less than you think. I don't know. I used a very facile phrase when we were talking about this that maybe this movie suffers from what I'm calling the serial problem, as in that you know, overly discussed podcast that launched 1,000 programs like it. in that maybe what this movie thinks all it needs to do is thoroughly re-report, and from there it's kind of done its job, and the making of an argument is up to you, the listener / viewer, which
okay
is, yeah it and is it, in fact a misreading
almost
of serial
gets there sometimes
yeah
but I just think that it's not. I don't know. There's part of me that feels like it's just not really okay. Like, you know, this woman is telling this story about trying to kill this doctor who's close to the Bhagwan. And, you know, the way it's like they reenact it with drawings and the way she tells it, she's a very good storyteller. Possibly a sociopath. I don't know. But you're the way that that sequence is done, you're encouraged to be on her side and think of this as an action sequence and not her trying to kill somebody. She does feel justified in doing it. She was ordered to do it, whatever the rationale. The film puts you on her side. Then you're not even told whether it worked or not until like the next episode when he shows up in some footage and you're like, well, I guess that failed. And then even later, she couldn't leave. I forget where she was. She couldn't leave Germany and her son was dying of a brain tumor. And she like turned herself in so that she could get compassionate leave to be with her son as he passed away. And then she would go to jail and she was given time served. And then the whole courtroom was filled with the joy of sisterly love. And she talked about being very touched by that. And I was like, but you tried to kill people, plural. Yeah. There was gun running. Like, I feel for you about your son. May he rest. But are we really supposed to find this heartwarming? Or are we supposed to find her a little poreless and like emotionally poreless and repellent in that moment? Because that's where I kind of landed with it, I got to say.
Oh, me too. And at the very least, they could have rounded that out by, why not find the doctor? You know, why not find the doctor and get his point of view, not from a local news footage from 1982, but
yeah,
presumably the man is still alive. Why not hear what he has to say about this experience? Why not hear if he was up to or perceived he was up to no good in tending to the Bhagwan's health? Or if you can't find him, say pull up a crawl for 2 seconds and say we tried to locate said doctor/almost murder victim and were unsuccessful.
Yeah. Or like,
but at least we made the attempt.
Chiron about the efforts to track down any number of these people would have been welcome. But I think you're right on with the serial problem. And, you know, the fact is, I think it could be enough to just surface the facts because it is a pretty wild story. It's extremely well built. These guys are talented directors.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, as Patty says in My So-Called Life, Graham, grow up, pick a side.
Yeah, it does feel a little immature and superficial. And I know these guys have three more documentaries in the pipeline for Netflix. And I certainly wouldn't, throw shade on what they're doing next or stomp my feet and pretend like I wasn't going to be interested. I am. I'm just using the serial problem as shorthand here, but if anyone re-listens to Serial, what they know is that half the reason that project was called Serial was to underline the inherent conflict between what is legally provable and what makes a good story. And in fact, Sarah Koenig says at the end, the way the story has played out, you may think Anand Saeed is guilty, but the simple truth is we do not have enough evidence of that. And that is the standard by which we assign guilt or innocence in the United States. And so they do in fact make an argument. And the argument is we have reported and we find we do not have enough. And you have to be okay with the not knowing because that's where we ended up.
I think you have to insert yourself into the text and say that's where we ended up. And I think maybe with a little more time at this, Los Way will maybe come to that or not. Maybe they're going to go in a more like Errol Morris, the medium is the message kind of stylized thing where this is how they do it. And they just refuse to, or like occasionally they'll put a thumb on the scale and you'll have to figure it out for yourself. Like that's the point of view.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it does hopefully point the way to what they will do better and different next time. I hope. And thankfully there will be a next time because Wild Wild Country is a wild, wild success. And,
yes.
But I think I think it is fair to say, 10 years from now, we will be looking at this as sort of the growing into themselves and coming into their big boy pants phase of the Los Way Hermanos director.
Indeed. And now for something completely different. Our cold case this week. Beautiful and Twisted, a Lifetime joint from a few years back, which I selected for us, because it was available on YouTube, and B, because Kevin Smogler is the author of a Brat Pack film book, and I thought it would be fun to look at a Rob Lowe starrer based on a real crime. There are a bunch of these. The one based on that Anne Rule book about the dentist was not so good. But here, Mr. Lowe is playing a real-life guy named Ben Novak Jr. Here's the case file. In 2009, Bernice Novak and her son, Fontainebleau Miami Beach hotel heir Ben Novak Jr., were murdered 3 months apart. Narcy Novak, nay Narcisa Velis Pacheco, Ben's estranged wife, was convicted of orchestrating the murders and, after a highly publicized trial, was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The Lifetime take on the story is more sympathetic to Novak the Lesser than perhaps is seemly, in my opinion, given that in real life he was cheating on Narcy with a porn star at the time of his death. Possibly this is because he, you know, looks like Rob Lowe, who's voicing over the thing. The movie also seems to be more about pushing the limits of what a basic cable network can say and show breast-wise in primetime than about an informative overview of this case. Not that Wikipedia was much help, but this was an extremely stylish and amusing 90 minutes, and I think the stigma of appearing in Lifetime movies has officially been lifted for everyone, because playing Bernice, Candace Bergen, playing the killer stripper, Paz Vega, looks beautiful. And Jude Chicalella's in it. Michelle Hurd shows up at one point. Like, they still make a gazillion of these things, and everyone's really having a ball. They're really not taking it all that seriously. There's definitely this like jazzy feel to it. Let's hear a little bit of Ben's posthumous Sunset Boulevard style intro to his sixth birthday party here at clip 9.
Betty, okay, the grown-ups are talking.
And my sixth birthday was a pretty good one.
Yeah, why don't you go up to your room, read some of your comics?
Yeah, why don't you get some of your birthday cake, honey?
Hey, my folks had a lot on their plates. I mean, who wants a six-year-old kid by then, you know? I gotta figure this is where I got my taste for everything. I mean, it was right in front of me. Everywhere. I high, ass, booze, drugs, all of them.
Yes, that was Candace Bergen you heard in that clip. There's a younger actress lip-syncing her lines in this flashback, which I thought was weird, but it's like, well, who else are you going to get to sound like Candace Bergen? The movie seems to have no idea what year everything that happened in it took place. It also seems to have no idea how old or young Rob Lowe looks. He's looked basically the same since A Basic Instinct.
Wayne's World, I'd say.
Yeah, or even earlier than that. Like, what was the one where he was that like rogue sexual Peter Pan who was like killing hookers with golf clubs and then blaming James Spader for it?
Bad Evidence.
Yes. It looked
pretty
good to me.
I'm sorry.
I love that movie.
Yeah. So tell me something. You're absolutely right. There is officially no more stigma in doing Lifetime movies anymore. It all just feels like something everybody says, well, I want to work with this person, this person, and this person, and it'll all be over in a week anyway.
Yes,
and we'll collect
exactly.
The paycheck. So why not? I do wonder. So I have this. This is my question about Rob Lowe. My question about Rob Lowe, or this half thought out supposition I have, is that everything Rob Lowe has done in the second half of his career, i.e., post getting caught, you know, messing with underage girls on videotape in an Atlanta hotel room,
right,
phase of his career, everything that Rob Lowe has done since then is a comment on Rob Lowe, the first half of Rob Lowe's career. Everything is a riff. Everything Rob Lowe does as a grown man is a riff on Rob Lowe as an 80s teen idol. From essentially being a satirized version of his former heartthrob self in Parks and Rec to being a character in the West Wing who has to embody values and a moral compass and never sort of gets to embody smoldering sexuality to even his small part in Wayne's World to the AT&T commercials he did where he's like, hi, I'm present Rob Lowe and I'm past Rob Lowe.
And then he basically did a modified In Search Of with his sons so that he could hang out with them and like go to haunted houses and look for Bigfoot.
Yeah.
He seems to be Rob Lowe.
he seems to be a guy who on the one hand doesn't care at all about the quality and type of work he does. And on the other hand is so self-aware about whom he used to be perceived as. And has spent the majority of his adult life taking roles that somehow wink at your memory of Rob Lowe in Oxford Blues or St. Elmo's Fire.
I think that's an excellent theory, actually. He certainly is like, I'm going to have to rename this. I used to call it the Matt Damon principle, but now he's kind of like on my shit list because of his responses to the Harvey Weinstein allegations, whatever.
Justifiable shit list.
Yeah, your boy's rapey. Don't help. Don't tell us how to feel and shut up. And no one cares if you built a zoo. You definitely don't have to do it again. But the idea is that
duct tape to help him shut up.
Yeah, seriously. He takes his work seriously, but not himself. I think in Matt Damon's case, he is starting to take himself a skosh seriously. But what I've always liked about Rob Lowe is that he seems to realize that based on his bone structure, he's going to have to just be the joke and be okay with it. And I think after a certain point, like after their little like, it's really hard being a Brad Packer pep rally where he was like complaining about being famous and then he got busted with underage girls.
Yeah.
I think after that, he was like, perhaps some different choices need to be made in which I'm a, you know, man and not a dude.
And he was a Southern California contemporary of Sean Penn and of James Spader. I'm not quite positive of that, but I think there was also a self-awareness of like, okay, I'm not gonna go methody and win a bunch of actors like Sean Penn. Like that is not my destiny. And Sean Penn has a face that can transform, and I have a face that will always look like it belongs on an advertisement for a Caribbean cruise.
Yeah, I mean, it's like an Ocean's 12 when they're like, "Wow, it's really uncanny how much you look like Julia Roberts." Like, I think that he has had a number of roles that were basically that. And he's fine with it and is not proud. There is some prep work that I think perhaps was not done for this next clip.
Don't bother him again! I'll kill you!
There's a lot of... apparently, Novak the Lesser was a big collector of Batmanabilia. He shows up in his, like, one of his, whatever, original Batmobiles from the Adam West series with the very Batmanoid music, as you could hear, and saves the, exotic dancer.
Right.
Who heretofore had...
If you ask me, was handling herself just fine in that scene.
Yeah,
before.
I had, I really did not, I was not worried for her, perhaps because she was, above the fold on the poster, but, we were not given any reason to worry about her handling herself, and, rescues her from some schmuck in the parking lot where nothing good ever happens. But there's a lot of this, like, he's the, you know, she's the Catwoman to his Batman. Batman only wanted to love Catwoman. Catwoman only wanted to screw over Batman and take his money. And there's a lot of this in the, a lot of this in the voiceover, but I really didn't like this movie is perfectly pleasurable. It just, it like goes right down.
Yeah.
It's like a Frappuccino. There's absolutely no nutritional value. You learn nothing except maybe not to get the whipped cream next time.
Yeah. Or at least not with that bubble shaped top where it ends up all over your nose.
Precisely. It's definitely empty calories. Like I said, there's no fidelity to like time in the set design or the wardrobe.
Right.
For every good actor I mentioned, there's other people present.
Yeah. there's also no fidelity to how these people actually looked. I did a quick Google image search on the real life late Ben Novak Jr. and his wife who murdered him. Ben Novak Jr. looks like Ron Perlman's, you know, layabout younger brother. Like he looks like the Roger Clinton to Ron Perlman. You know, with a bad beard and serial killer 80s glasses, Rob Lowe's doing him a lot of favors.
They keep putting the amber visions on Rob Lowe. It's like, but it's still Rob Lowe with amber visions and a bad beard. I will say this, if you are planning to like rent this from Amazon Prime or whatever, or watch it on YouTube after he is thrown the fatal beating, spoiler, I guess, in his hotel room and is still making like moaning sounds and refusing to die. There's this one close up of what is left of his toothless upper jaw. Like maybe wardrobe was stoned and checked out, but monster makeup was right on top of that rose. Oh, it was awful. And I happened to pause it. And then my husband came in and was like, oh my God, are you like, what is this? Like a home autopsy course? I was like, yes, that's me.
Yeah. There is something really, really right up to the line on basic cable with this. And I don't really care one way or another. I'm not particularly squeamish about such things.
I'm not either. Wonder, it was just like in a Lifetime movie, which they also found a way around the like nipple prohibition, I noticed.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Yeah, what's
about
it actually
either,
but adding to this story, if anything? I think aesthetically, one of the chief pleasures is if that, you know, sort of, even though this is Fort Lauderdale, I don't know why the family lives in Fort Lauderdale if the Fountain Blue Hotel is in Miami. That's almost an hour away.
Because they're trash, Soikas Peanut. That's why.
But if you really like that sort of Miami Vice architecture where everything looks like a series of all the houses look like a series of white blocks stacked up on top of each other.
Yeah. A lot of glass brick, a lot of never eating marinara inside again. Yep.
Yes.
For sure.
Yes. Living in a permanent film of Mr. Clean. So fingerprints don't end up on anything white because everything is white. If you're into that, this movie has it by the house full.
There is also the most hilarious recreation of a wedding photo ever taken at their wedding, which apparently either was catered by or took place at a Hooters. And Miss Candace Bergen is there to work in the shade department in clip 11.
You know, I thought a Batman themed bar mitzvah was tacky, but this really can't compare.
It was his idea.
Well, we were going to have it at the strip club, but that food is terrible.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to you. I hope you'll both be very happy. And have a good lawyer.
Oh, but we do. They helped us with a prenup.
Her idea.
Well, that's very romantic.
Oh.
Let me just say, I have loitered you know, unseemingly in the Fontainebleau lobby just because I was curious and I look harmless in Midwestern and so nobody asks any questions. But the Fontainebleau Hotel is not what you'd call an example of taste in architecture or interior design. It is almost glorious and singing that on a you know, full throatedly in its excess and gaudiness and conspicuous consumption and wealth.
Well, and the Sinatra piano and all that, like, yeah. To have the waspiest Lady Wasp, whoever Lady Wasped, playing this, you know, Disney Coast matron who, mm-mm. I mean, they try to give her like that big lion's mane of 80s hair and too much jewelry, but it's Candace Bergen. She used to be
a little white dog.
Model. Yeah. Oh my God. The little white dog.
I mean, they should have just nicknamed that dog. Will be branded with a bloody handprint, you know, arf, arf. Because that's why you have a little white dog in a murder mystery movie.
That's true. Poor puppy.
But yeah. So let me ask you one question, Sarah. Did this whole project feel a little misogynistic to you? The takeaway from it is you got some money. There's a beautiful yet dangerous woman out there looking to relieve you of it.
Well, like I said up top, it felt much more sympathetic to Benny than a straight reading of the Wikipedia entry would indicate, at least to me. And they sort of try to address this in passing that, you know, she starts getting jealous and he's like, you know, you knew what I was when you married me. And then there's all this sort of like attempts to construct this fiction of like an amour fou or like some kind of BDSM situation, which, like, I mean, that's all fine, but it's like, you know, and I'm not trying to step to the dancing sector of the sex worker industry here, but dude, like, that it just, like, Casino already did this, right?
So we
don't really need to see it again, because that was Sharon Stone's best performance in anything. It defined the genre, and now everybody else in film needs to stop doing it for at least another 5 years. Not that this didn't actually happen, but here's where I was struggling a little. The movie occasionally stepped back into like what we're really doing here, which is that human beings were killed and people left without their parents and whatnot. Not that the acting of the grown-up May would necessarily engender a huge amount of sympathy for her, but that's not really her fault. It's the writing. We'll get into it. But as sort of fluffy and angel food cake as this movie is, I felt a little bit, not guilty, but just like, this actually, it should be the new definition of a guilty pleasure, because it is really like this jazzy fun caper, but it's about murder, and I'm not entirely sure. Like, I think they either had to be completely like Heathersian about it or try to take a little more seriously the fact that people were beaten to death, and like really beaten really to death.
Yeah.
Did you agree? Like, is there a weird sort of like tonal issue here? Maybe.
There absolutely is. I will admit, like, one of my favorite genres of cinema and television is like Dominic Dunn cinema and television, you know, like the misdeeds of rich people being mean and cruel to each other. Like, I really like that filmed Vanity Fair article kind of movies and television.
Same.
But you do have to, you do have to admit up front that you are interested in it because of the people involved, social standing. Otherwise it's just a series of violent acts. And B, tone is everything because the story is announcing itself up front as lurid and tabloidy and a little shameful. And so I think you can do sort of the dark, moody, study in emptiness the way Foxcatcher is, for example.
Sure.
Or you can do the glitzy wastefulness of a movie like The Bling Ring, which kind of makes sense because you're talking about aspirational young people. And so the fast music video editing of that movie sort of underlines the superficiality and the emptiness of what these kids seek. The tone here feels wrong because ultimately what you're talking about is the grisly murder of two people who, whatever their flaws, didn't deserve to be, beaten to death in a garage and in a hotel suite.
This is, I think, my bottom line issue with it is that, Narcy perhaps was driven crazy by her husband, but what she arranged to happen to happen to him and to her mother-in-law, I mean, it is really grisly. And there's everybody involved in the project is clearly like having a good time, and I'm all for people enjoying their work. And I don't think you need to be like performatively somber about every single thing that was adjacent to a death. Mm-hmm. But I think you make a really good point that there's the sort of gusto with which the late narrator of the Forensic Files, for one example, took in narrating these stories. And the, this is, fun and sexy,
I mean, like,
just make a movie about that part. And then, like, you have to shift gears once the killie starts, you really have to shift gears and be a little, either really push that, like, outre flashy, it was fun until it died tone.
Yeah, it plays way too much like an Elmore Leonard novel, and and Elmore Leonard novels are deliberately are like announced that they are fiction in big screaming neon letters.
Well, and if you want it to be noir, use the tropes of noir. It's allowed to be funny. But, and I mean, there's a moment like 10 minutes from the end where it's like suddenly they realize that you weren't supposed to be paying quite so much attention to Paz Vega's boobs / her evident joy in stuffing a Chanel tote full of packs of $100 bills. Like, I mean, it's gorgeous to look at, and at the still not quite out of the tail end of a long winter here in the Northeast, it looked really fun to relax by the pool and have a massage, but not everyone approves, and their attempts to remind us of that felt clunky and insincere at best. Here's our last clip.
No, I don't want a massage. I'm in mourning for my father. You don't seem to give a damn that he's dead. Murdered. Brutally. Horribly. And now look at you, while your husband is rotting in some meat locker, waiting for a decent burial. Here you are, just living like the queen of the castle without a care in the world. Except for how you're gonna spend Dad's money.
My money. Not for long.
Please note a couple of things. The acting is
more than a couple.
The acting is wretched because the writing is completely by numbers. And in fact, sounds like it was imparted to the actors in a string of ones and zeros. It's that rote.
Oh, yeah.
Please note also the peppy salsa music underscoring the scene. Like, I actually tried to Shazam that song because the song is like really great and fun. And I was like, I would enjoy going, you know, on my old lady walks to this song and try to put out of my mind what was happening, which was that the fiery Latina followed her own daughter out to her car and fucked it up with a tire iron that was by the pool. Why?
Right. Right. they couldn't have just made it a pool cleaning brush because I mean, like,
or like find some, I don't know, like someone in, you know, a pool boy. Like, are there any other problematic, like, tropey roles that we want to throw in here? Like, that was also a big, a big issue for me. Like, I didn't feel like the script felt that. That she was like the, you know, stereotypical spicy Latinx lady. So it wasn't too bad, but especially that scene, it's like, just have a mariachi band follow her out there playing Yellow Bird and then serve some Tostitos. Like, the fuck are you doing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then drape the Puerto Rican flag from the windows of the garage as they charge out into the driveway. Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a Lifetime movie. It's not perfect. It's not claiming to be perfect. But yeah, I did have to point out that amidst the, yeah, there were a couple of turds in the Frappuccino, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that bubble lid was a smart idea. The tone, I think you're absolutely right. Given how unseriously everybody in the cast seems to be taking it, and given that the tone, you know, the tone is so breezy that you could be standing by the side of the road and this movie would go whoosh by you in 3 minutes and you wouldn't even feel it, you know, feel it going by.
Yeah. Might be a little mud splatter though.
The fact that it is about a grisly murder of two people who I think you could have found a story this soapy, this trashy, this much fun for this exact same group of actors to be in that didn't involve people getting bludgeoned to death.
Yeah, agree. I did want to just confirm that this was not the subject of a Power, Privilege, and Justice or Dominic Dunn's Bloody Hollywood or whatever. He had a few of those shows, I think.
Yeah.
It was not. It's been on My Dirty Little Secret on ID, 48 Hours, Dateline, Snapped, and True Crime with Aphrodite Jones, which I really can't recommend. But if they're still making those Dominic Dunn things, they should do one on that, because that would just be the perfect venue for it.
It is the Dominic Dunn thing that's ever been done.
and sadly won't be. Did you read his book, The Stories People Told Me, or whatever it's called?
No. And that is an oversight, and given what my interests are, I absolutely should read his book. The guy was always interested in really kind of trashy subjects that made you feel like you needed to sanitize your whole body after reading. But he was a brilliant storyteller. You can imagine every story that he focused on being told poorly and clunkily, and he managed to do it in this wonderfully addictive way.
Maybe we should resurrect. We've only done one, the Blotter Presents Book Club, because we wanted to talk about the Michelle McNamara, but maybe we should resurrect it. You and I can read that book for work and then pick a particularly juicy episode of the show. I'm pretty sure they rerun it all the time.
Yeah, love that idea.
But enough about that behind the curtain peek into our scheduling process. It's time for the Be on the Lookout Bulletin. Kevin, where else can listeners find you and your work?
First of all, I love that drop. I could listen to that siren drop all day long.
You're a strange lad. I'll play it again though, just for you.
Thank you. Maybe to know it's coming from you and not from the street below
is a psychological sleight of hand.
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at WeegeeWeeGee, at KevinSmokler.com on the web. And I am the author of the new book, Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies.
And you know where to find me, folks, right here in 2 weeks. Coming up on our booking sheet, Dangerous Son, the HBO documentary on Bad Seeds, Evil Genius from the aforementioned production team. And coming in June, Joe Berlinger's The Wrong Man. Got a tip for the Blotter Presents Case Files? Visit our forums at previously.tv or hit me on social media at Blotter Presents. That's on both Facebook and Twitter. My guest has been Kevin Smokler, and you can find him on Twitter, as he said, at Weegee. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I am on Twitter at Tomato Nation as well. We will talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.